Danny is a long-standing author with us. He's got a very long title, so I'm just going to read it back. He's the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford, which means that he's the most important, surely, in the whole world. But the thing that Danny, I think, is most famous for is talking about inequality, particularly in the UK, and that's really what we're going to focus in on the next 40 minutes. So Danny's going to give a short introduction, 5-10 minutes, to his new book, which is called Peak Inequality, and we'll find out what that means. Then he and I are going to have a few sort of questions and answers, and then we're going to open it up to you. I think we're going to try and do that as early as possible, really, because we want to hear from you and we want to get you involved in this conversation. So, Danny, shall I hand it over to you?
Yep. Thank you. Thanks ever so much, Leah. I need to say thanks in particular because Verso are doing something that no other publisher does. They're actually allowing me to talk about a book published by somebody else. Peak Inequality is published by Policy Press, the University of Bristol. And not just that, but this cover was actually picked by Leo, who wanted me to put it on a book that Verso published 5 years ago. And I said, no.
You were too scared.
I was too scared, because I just turned up at the University of Oxford. And the idea of putting some pigs on the cover of a book when I was new might not make my colleagues happy. It was a stupid mistake, because the day before Inequality in the 1% was published, Piggate came out. And we all wanted to know where the Prime Minister had put his whatever, and whether the animal was dead or not. And if I'd been brave enough, anyway, book still did okay. The tragedy at the moment is that books on inequality sell well. And they sell well because we're living in very unequal times. In case you're wondering what on earth we're doing at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday in Wilderness, talking about it, this is the perfect time and the perfect place. This is what a peak of inequality feels like. Just afterwards, it's the kind of come down. It's like a hangover. Coming down from the peak is not great. So we'll talk about that a little bit more. But essentially, there are loads and loads of signs that as far as income is concerned, the gap between us is beginning to shrink and may well shrink more. The signs began in 1990 for people who were not well off. The very last signs came this year, when for the first time we saw that bankers' pay was falling, when the European Commission actually released the data, and also the most highly paid man in the country lost his job. And so I collect these kind of signs and signs of hope. The other reason why Wilderness is the perfect place to do this is that this is kind of the epitome of inequality. There's a kind of competition between latitude and Wilderness, kind of Cambridge and Oxford, but which one is the most unequal, the poshest festival? I think, obviously, being from Oxford, I think this one wins. If you want an example of the extremes, apparently, I don't know if any of you've done it, the top end glamping here is about £10,000 for a yurt with your own butler. And I think that's on the lawn of the house. And we can all feel like we're slumming it now. Because I guess, we can't all have the butler. And then, of course, you can go down and down and down through the hierarchy. The lowest I saw was one of the women on security down by the lake. The woman who has been particularly offensive, by the way. And if she annoyed you, don't be annoyed. I overheard her talking about the £7 curry. And I listened. What she was actually talking about was, could she get the slip which would allow her to have the £7 curry without having to pay £7, because she doesn't have £7. The inequality within the walls and fences of this festival is quite amazing. There are 8,000 members of crew. And if you want an example, the last time Britain was this, we weren't quite as unequal now as then, 1913-14. And back then you had country houses for the staff, and the only time there would be more people being served than the staff would be the weekend parties. And if you like, this is the modern day equivalent of a weekend party. You don't feel that you are the kind of guest in the country house, because you become used to this kind of inequality. Just as people left over 100 years ago rocking up to some country house and being served, it's just another weekend, just another festival. And that's the kind of world we're living in at the moment. It's going to reduce, most probably. Never again will somebody be paying £10,000 to spend a weekend in a yurt with a butler, assuming they don't go to anything down by the lake. Well, what the hell's the butler doing the rest of the time? I can go on and on about inequality, but I think it's worth just thinking about whether this is the long, hot summer before the end. 1914 was a very long, hot summer. There's a picture in the book, I'll pick it out in a minute and show you, of some boys at a cricket match, at a Harrow Eton cricket match of June 1914. At that very peak, they're cheering on their teams. They have absolutely no idea of what's going to come. What happened was a disaster that was only supposed to last a few months. It went on for years. Then agitation, strikes, revolution, a second war, and eventually by the 1940s and 50s, we began to realize that we had become more equal. By the 1960s, a judge was asking people, is this a book you would like your wife, your children, and your servants to read? And somebody had to point out to the judge there weren't any servants anymore. The future for Britain, if we do begin to become more equal as we are, is we're heading towards being a normal European country. And in a normal European country, there are no servants anymore. People can afford to have children. School teachers can have children. If you want to know what a servant is, it's somebody who can't have kids. And people who are used to being served will have to get used to doing things much more for themselves. I'm going to stop waffling then and let Leo start to interrogate me.
Okay, so let's sort of think of what peak inequality was. Does it still exist? Are we just on the cliff edge, or is it actually seeing signs of the decline? And in particular, how does inequality sort of manifest itself? Clearly, the most obvious gauge is in terms of sort of income, but there's lots of hidden costs of inequality, particularly to health. And I think there's one statistic that you use, which is absolutely fascinating, which is about life expectancy. And in particular, that it's only within the last 5 years that life expectancy has actually started to drop for the first time since records.
Since
the Second World War. And that very much is one that is based upon sort of social position. Also, I think it feeds in every kind of aspect of the sort of terrain of everyday life. So do we want to talk about, let's talk about health to begin with, and how this, in some ways, these sort of hidden costs of inequality.
Yeah. You get used to living in an unequal country, so it becomes normal. So you look around, particularly when it's sunny and it hasn't rained, and you go, well, it's not that bad. And the problem is you become used to it, so you don't realise how bad it is. On health, I'll start with kids. Back in 1990, we were the seventh best country in Europe for neonatal mortality. Only six did you have a better chance as a newborn baby of living. By 2015, we're the 19th. Portugal does better than us. When I was born, a baby was three times more likely to die in Portugal than in this country. We're 19th. On the current trajectory, we're likely in 10 years' time to go beneath Romania for our infant mortality rate. That's where we're heading. In the last 2 years, the number of babies who died was higher than the year before. The rate of deaths of babies was higher both times, according to ONS. The last time infant mortality rose twice in a row was during the Second World War. There is nowhere else in Europe where babies are becoming more and more likely to die. The chances are still very small, but they're rising. I think they're rising because these deaths are in the first few days of life, because our actual care around giving birth is getting worse, because it's harder to get midwives, put it very, very crudely. You often hear people say, oh, it's because more people are having babies early. seeing premature babies. They're having premature babies all over the rest of Europe, right? But they're not seeing the rise in infant mortality that we have. It hardly gets any reporting at all. We finally got UPIM 2 days ago to write a story on the BBC News website. That took 20 emails to UPIM, the health correspondent of the BBC. On life expectancy, began about 2012, 2013, very small drops, 5.5 weeks for elderly women. As of June this year, ONS has said that the overall mortality rate for everybody in England has risen by 5% in 1 year. ONS released that 2 weeks after Jeremy Hunt said there is no evidence of any rise in mortality. Brexit, we're trying to put off talking about Brexit for as long as we can.
Yeah.
Brexit has allowed things like this to occur without any kind of knowledge of it. And in a way, we've become American. Americans are not aware that they have the lowest life expectancy in the rich world, that their children have the smallest chances of getting to age 5 or 15. They don't know. And we're the Europeans who haven't got a clue. There are 19 countries in Europe where women live longer than here. Lastly, to say on this, it's not the immigrants. The immigrants are fit and thin and well educated. The babies who are dying in greater numbers are the babies of mothers born in England. It's not immigrant babies. Their bad health is not from people coming. In 2015, we had one of the first big rises in deaths. The only age group to not see a rise in deaths was age 25 to 29. It was the age group which had 60,000 net young, healthy, thin immigrants in it who came. Once people stop coming from mainland Europe, which has already begun, the fall we're beginning to get in life expectancy accelerates. And we just don't realise that part of the reason we don't look even worse is because we had this deal where we brought in their young and fit, and we sent out about 1 million of our decrepit and elderly. David Cameron's dad died in France. Nick Clegg's dad is in France. It's an amazing deal. You get the young in, you send the old out. And when that ends, that just adds to this. But the problem with being so unequal is it affects our brains. So you just go, oh, well, when you hear that life expectancy is falling, you go, well, do we really want to live that long? Do we want to spend all that money on their care? Do we want the Meals on Wheels services back again, which have all been cut? Do we want the half of adult social service visits, which have been cut, to be returned? Do we want kind of pension credits to be at a decent level? Do we want to have somebody having a catheter inserted them in a hospital in a way that's kind or caring? Or is it a bit more economically efficient just to let them die on the bed in a trolley? And if we're going to win the global race to becoming the richest country in the world, George Osborne's race, we can't afford to be soft. The saddest kind of case of this, he's still alive, Andrew Lansley. Andrew Lansley was health secretary. One of the cuts he introduced was to reduce the amount of screening for bowel cancer. Andrew Lansley is currently dying of bowel cancer. But the mentality of inequality is, these are prices worth paying. The really interesting thing about studying inequality is when you discover that there's a set of people who think that there are a series of prices worth paying for other people to be able to have more holidays, more cruises, more incentive to create wealth. All that kind of stuff, that kind of mindset, only develops as strongly as it has here because we have this huge gap between us.
And so the other thing about sort of inequality is it doesn't just live in the present. I mean, it also pays its way forward. Mm. And this is really the sort of question of sort of social mobility. I mean, I think most people have heard of Michael White's book, The Rise of Meritocracy, which often is sort of seen as a blueprint of how a society should be, that the suggestion that meritocracy is in fact a good thing. And in fact, Michael White's book is a damning condemnation of meritocracy, as in many ways he predicted what was going to happen now. So talk about sort of social mobility.
Okay, good. Michael Young. He did predict in 2034 that things will, there will be a revolution, but you never know. He's been right so far. Michael Young helped pen the 1945 Labour Manifesto. He helped set up the Open University. I think he did the Consumers Association. He also he also produced Toby, which I think is helped partly prove his thesis. In a very unequal society, which we're in, you don't let your children drop down. You don't do that. You try as hard as you possibly can to keep your children in the group you're in. Who here is in a household where, between you, if there's two of you, before tax, you're getting about 70,000 a year? So 35 each, 70,000 a year plus. Hands high up, go on, bravery. Bravery, Wilders. 70,000 a year. Leo, hand up. Right. 70,000 a year more. Okay. Right, let's drop down between 50 and 70. There should be more of you. It's like a normal curve. Oh, sorry, okay. Over the 70. No. All right. The 70,000 plus, you're the 10%. I'm in the 10%. You work very hard to avoid your children in future being below the 10%, because it's quite hard to imagine life below. Below the 10%, might be tricky to get a mortgage, might be renting your whole life in future. The idea of going on holiday in the winter as well as the summer doesn't exist. Half of all children in Britain had no summer holiday, no holiday at all last year, which you don't know about if you're in the 10%, you're just worried about only having one. So social mobility is lower in this country than anywhere else in Europe, and it's lower because people like me and you work very hard to stop our children taking jobs which would put them in the bottom half of society and allow other people's children to go up. In a more equal country, you can pick anywhere in Europe, it's not hard, because the gap in income is much less, your children can do what they want. They are much more free to do the kind of job they might be interested in, rather than having to go into finance or whatever you've got planned for them. And being sent to the right Russell Group University, I don't know, to do geography, because it's a really good route into banking. You may not know that. I've spent the last 30 years teaching geography in universities. What do my undergraduates do? They become bankers. Why were our banks so bad? So social mobility is particularly low. The government used to have a Child Poverty and Social Mobility Commission. They then dropped the child poverty bit because they don't really care about that. They just kept social mobility. Poverty is okay. If you're into inequality, poverty's fine. You've just got to pick the one or two little golden children out, the little Michael Goves. You have to spot them and bring them up. And so they just had a Social Mobility Commission. And then all the commissioners resigned last year. And they're trying to hire again. If any of you are interested, go on the Cabinet Office website, where they're saying, please will you be a commissioner of the Social Mobility Commission, and send them in an email saying you're interested. You can do it now. If you've got 5G or whatever, it works at this festival. You know, Cabinet Office, have a look. Say, I want to be a commissioner on your Social Mobility Commission. Anyway, to me, I might sound a bit trite. I've been doing this for too long. I've got some books down here. I've done 10 books in the last 10 years on inequality, all with more evidence. Unequal societies have low social mobility because the rich will not sacrifice the future of their children. If you can bring inequality down, if you bring things together, the rich don't have to be so petrified about the future of their children. Their children can do different things. They can even have boyfriends or girlfriends of a different social class. And you don't have to be embarrassed when you meet the parents. This happened in the 1960s and 70s in this country. And that kind of thing is possible. You don't have to worry about, well, you know, if he marries her, will we be putting down the deposit on the house in Fulham? Because her parents won't be contributing. You know, that kind of thing goes away.
And moving on, well, I think Fulham is the perfect place to start talking about that London, and how different London is in terms of, I suppose, the rest of the country. As an example, as a sort of petri dish of inequality, does London, is it off the scale compared to the rest of the UK?
No, this is old. Andrew Neil. Any of you know Andrew Neil, that bloke on the telly? The few times Andrew Neil's ever had me on, He goes, it's just London, isn't it? It's just London. If you take London out, this is a normal country. And I go to him and go, no, we've taken London out, and the slope's just as steep. London is the most extreme, but you take it out and we're just as unequal a country. Scotland is almost as unequal as the UK. There isn't a London in Scotland. There were a lot of private schools in Edinburgh. Yeah, it's the same kind of thing. So it isn't just London. But unequal countries make it easier to have an all-powerful capital city that grows and is dominant and gets its way. I mean, the next most unequal country, if you take the wider Europe, is Russia, which has Moscow, which is a similar size as compared to the rest of its country as London, the rest of the UK. And the one after that is Turkey and Istanbul. So, and the other thing these three have in common, we shouldn't kick ourselves too much about this, these three countries are the centres, the hearts of former empires. And one thing that makes a place very unequal is a legacy of having been very, very powerful. And you kind of get addicted to the idea that you're special, that you're different, that just allowed to go free yourself with your superior English genes, you can rule the world and become rich. And the only thing holding you back are those dodgy continentals who don't want you to do that, and the traitorous hippie socialists in your midst who don't understand that Empire 2.0 is the way ahead.
But the one thing that is surely true about London that is in some ways an example of sort of extreme inequality is housing. I mean, do you have predictions for all these people here about, you know, where their property is going to go? Is it going to go up or is it going to go down?
Don't buy unless you're downsizing, is my advice. So one chapter in the book is a little article Ben Hennig and I wrote for The Guardian in August 2016. And even in August 2016, using data from Zoopla, you could see the beginnings of the fall in the London housing market, that early on. It's been falling since then. I know we'll keep it to ourselves because you don't have to talk about this, but you know it's falling. How many are from London, by the way? I'm assuming, okay, towards a half, right? You know it's falling. You don't want to tell yourself it's falling. You want to tell yourself it's falling most at the very top, which you're right. It is falling most in those places that were worth 20 million and now 15.
Well, no, it's not. It's at the very top, it's fine. It's then at the 5 million.
Well, the 5 million, I knew you were doing. I'm not in your bracket. But it should be. I mean, Bishop's Avenue. If any of you ever get a chance to walk up Bishop's Avenue, it's derelict. They're worth billions. It's derelict. The really interesting thing about a moment about London property market, it's a safe place to put your money. Imagine you're from Brazil and you've got about 100 million. You're going to play with 90 million around the world trying to make money on that. But 10, you'll park in London. And that 10 is for the long term. And the long term is your great grandchildren. You're not wanting to sell that. So the top end of the market is a safety deposit box for people who want somewhere safe, where the rules and laws of property are respected and preserved. And then you've got an opposition party who says that they will consider compulsory purchase at agricultural prices for land around Oxford, and compulsory purchase for hostel beds so that nobody has to be on the streets 100 days after the election of a Labour government. And I'm wondering how long it's going to take people who've got their safety deposit box, being a large six-bed detached house in Hampstead, how long is it going to take them to think, this isn't necessarily the safest place in the world for my money? And that's your top end. The flats are holding up. The 300, you can get a flat for 350 in London, it's just possible. Tiny one, dodgy area. They're kind of just holding up because, you know, the rent is much more than that. But only just. And the whole lot is teetering. There's a wave that's gone out from London. It's gone past through Oxford now. It's heading to Bristol. And it's the wave of, first of all, transactions fall by 4 times in 12 months. Nobody sells. Nobody buys. And then you begin to notice 10% off, 10% off. That's where we're at. But it's all going to be great. It's all going to be great because there's going to be this amazing thing this autumn when our Prime Minister walks hand in hand with the leaders of Europe and they announce the most sophisticated and best red, white and blue deal you've ever had, and the market's just going to rise and rise and the pound will strengthen, and we'll be the Singapore of the West, despite the fact that ships don't actually need to go past our port. We're going to be the Singapore of the West. So don't worry, it's all going to be fine. But if you've got a chance to sell, sell now. Just sell now and get out of London.
And thinking about the capable hands that we're in, I'm sure none of you saw The Telegraph yesterday. None of you read such filth. But there was a wonderful column by the former editor called Charles Moore, in which he proposed that a very strange thing was happening within the current Conservative government, in that there were no ministers from Eton in the cabinet. And so he asked the question, where is the future talent going to come from? Which I'm sure, and then he came up with a very good argument why we should be hiring more Etonians to run the country. But who is going to be running this country? And is the question, or is the answer, not us?
Not people like us. Keeping this country run by a small coterie of people who went to the right university, only Nick Clegg went to Cambridge, all the rest go to Oxford. Keeping the country run just by that group is really, really difficult. I mean, it's inconceivable that that kind of hold on power of Oxford's going to carry on. Part of the battle in the PLP of the Labour Party is between Oxford PPE educated Labour MPs who thought they had a job for life versus a wider party of 500,000 members who wouldn't mind the odd MP who'd gone to Oxford, but just one or two, right? Not over half of them. That's the way we're going. One reason it's taken this long is that you have to be my age or younger to live in a country which wasn't completely segregated by schools. I'm in the first cohort where it became majority comprehensive at age 12 or 13 in the 1970s. Anybody older than me, if you hadn't gone private or to grammar, that was it. Anybody younger than me, you're in a different world. We have the most segregated education in the whole of Europe. There is nowhere else in Europe that sends 7% to private schools and spends over a third of the entire spending on them. It is the most bizarre segregation you could ever see, but we're used to it. And it's part of the social mobility thing. If you send your kids to a school where you think their future will be safe from what you're spending. But I cannot see this country opting for the kind of Singapore model, being governed by our betters in future, being the home to billionaires, the future for most of our children being to work in some kind of service for the rich. Working in service was the most common job for a woman 100 years ago. Working in service will be new. My favourite example is being a teacher in Oxford. If you're a school teacher in Oxford, unless you have a trust fund, you cannot get a mortgage. You can only rent privately and you've only got one room, and you could be evicted with 2 months' notice. So you can't start a family. If you can't start a family, you are a servant. You are working for others, for their lives and not for your life. And that's the situation we're in, and that situation will accelerate if people allow the Etonians to come back. Not all Etonians are bad, by the way. There's a lot of them, they have four postcodes. If you're trying to track down Eton, it actually has four separate postcodes and chucks a lot of boys through. Last thing to say about Eton, and one reason not to see this as a battle between rich and poor, if you go into the geography house at Eton, there's a board, and on the board it says who got A stars and who got A's last year. Nobody gets a B. Now, can you imagine taking a load of pre-pubescent boys and teaching them to 10 o'clock every night and forcing every last one of them to get an A or an A star at their A levels. In the good old days, a third would just go into the city without A levels, a third would go into the guards. The occasional one is still allowed into the guards. He married well recently. But the bulk of the boys, this is boys, girls, puberty's earlier, it's easier. The bulk of the boys at Eton and at similar expensive schools are given the kind of education that in a decent country would be illegal. That forcing you at that age to get those grades, right, out of, you just can't do it in a humane way. It is not a nice, it really, and so, I mean, Leo told me never to try and do this, but this is the audience who might most, we ought to have enormous sympathy for the rich. The rich, the best off 1% in places like Sweden and Norway, even France, which is more equal to Germany, have much happier lives. The best off 1% in Germany go to state schools with other children. The private school in Bonn, the city that's twin of Oxford, the private school is reserved for the very, very slow children of the very rich. And all their lives they'll know that they're labelled as very slow. And the most famous student of that school in Bonn is Prince Philip. Imagine going to be living in a country where even if you're amongst the very richest, you can actually grow up in a normal way understanding the country you're in. That's what future we could have. And it's a future which nobody would be saying, where is the talent? Eton. The way you get into Eton, for the bulk of boys at Eton, is your father puts your name down at birth. Right? That's the way. I mean, a selection test wouldn't be great either. They do have a test. But honestly, the idea of Eton is hereditary genius. That the British race has produced a few particular geniuses at the very top, and they need to rule. If they don't rule, all will go wrong. Where did this idea of the British genius come from? It came from the fact that at the point when Charles Darwin published that book, where the subtitle was The Favoured Races, we owned half the world. Those at the top made an obvious conclusion. We own half the world. Ability is inherited. We must be the best. That's why we have our particular schooling system and we have a legacy of it. It's a great schooling system if you need to run half the world. Brutalising young men, making them fairly savage, and then sending them out to kill other people elsewhere so you can keep hold of your territories requires a public school system. The problem comes when you no longer have an empire to send them to. And then you get what we see in this country now.
So I think it's probably worth opening it up to the audience now. This is both for comments and questions or debating points. I mean, I think clearly we will be covering Brexit, whether that's a shock that we need or that's actually a shock that will have some huge damage. So if you can all put your hands up if you want to have a question, I'm going to try and, should we do what sort of groups of questions?
Two.
Okay. If I can ask you, madam, and then over there, is there a roving mic? Yeah.
I read somewhere that Brexit was, the people pushing Brexit are the top politicians. It was to do with people like Jacob Rees-Mogg being excluded from a European directive that was going to make them disclose their wealth. Do you think there's something in that?
And, hand up there.
Yeah, the man at the back there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Tatum. Just a question on two things and the impact on inequality. So one is like the traditional model, which is outsourcing, and what impact that has, but also one which is quite difficult too, which is automation.
Okay.
To an extent, and AI.
Great, okay. Very quickly on those three. The Brexit vote is absolutely fascinating. For me, that's the next book. We kind of finished the draft, so I can go on and on about it. It's absolutely fascinating. There was a group with money behind it they were trying to avoid the inspection for taxation. They didn't want European controls on our treasure islands, Belize, the Cayman Islands, and so on. So that's part of it. But there was also a big, what do you do if you're pissed off with life? You either vote that you like the government or you vote Leave. So there was a big pissed off vote as well. The Leavers didn't expect to win. They were not ready to win. They were ready to get 48% and call for another referendum. You can see the shock when they won. They'd done all the calculations. They weren't supposed to win. And now they're in trouble because it's got to happen by the 29th of March.
We're all in trouble, is that just
that? We're all in trouble. But their plan was we'll go for it once, then we'll go for it the second time. We'll soften people up. When we don't get Brexit the first time, we'll say everything that's gone wrong is the fault that we didn't leave. The whole thing becomes more plausible, but we're in trouble. Outsourcing makes switch to people who have shares in Carillion, or it did. It's entirely inefficient. You outsource things which are small to local builders. You don't outsource to giant companies and expect not to get ripped off. This is why other states in Europe have things in-house, have train companies in-house and so on. Outsourcing happens when you're being stupid and you're rewarding your friends for their companies. AI, I wouldn't worry about AI and robots as much as people do. I grew up in Oxford. I was taken to see the car plant as a small boy. I think it's a kind of warning of what would happen if I didn't work hard. There were 40,000 men on the lines when I was a boy. It was the most appalling thing, watching people welding on a production line. There are now 1,200 robots. It's absolutely silent. A mini car comes off every 1 minute, 2 seconds. It's 1% of our entire manufacturing output in the UK. All done by robots. The whole thing is rather beautiful to see. You can pay for a tour. There is one manual line left, but the robots turn the cars upside down so the men don't have to strain. The men on that manual line are all from Eastern Europe, I think living in sheds in Oxford. The irony is that those 1,200 robots can all be fitted, each one, in the back of an articulated lorry. And you can move the BMW plant to the Austrian-Czech border where the site is waiting, because you wouldn't be stupid enough to try and make mini cars in Oxford after Brexit. Right, we are in for such a piece of education. That's what I call it. We're about to learn, we're gonna learn this summer exactly what we're worth. And the really interesting thing is that unlike Greenland, which is the only other place that's left the EU, we don't have big stocks of fish. Which is why it took 3 years to negotiate with Greenland, because they had something worth bargaining over. But just think, what is it? What is it that we actually have? And then watch the people from the mainland doing a really good job of not having an expression of pity at their face as this thing rolls out. I'm trying to goad you to somebody saying Empire 2.0 is going to work. The competition on the mainland this summer is, don't show the pity. Don't be the person that the British turn to and say, oh, we hate you because you showed us pity. Let us work it out for ourselves that we have nothing to bargain with this summer.
Excellent. Let's get some more questions. I'm going to ask you and you, madam.
Thank you. So, thinking of other countries that have maybe gone through the process of reducing inequality, other than the bloody revolution, have there been any successful models that have reduced inequality?
I'll do that quickly because my memory's not good. Inequality is falling in most countries of the world now. It's falling in most rich countries in the world. It's a myth to think it can only actually rise. The fastest way to become more equal is a disaster. Japan is the quickest ever. Germany's pretty fast. Finland, I never realised. Finland had a dubious status in the Second World War, but actually helped remove the elite. Wars and revolutions, losing a war, you get rid of your elite. A bit like the Eton question. Getting rid of your elite always turns out to be good. There's always a better elite. They might not be great, they might be corrupt as well, but they're never quite as bad. There are lots of models of slow equality. Switzerland and the Netherlands are my favourite two. Over 50 years, both of them have become progressively more equal. The Netherlands is now, the top 1% take about 6 times average income. That's what we were like in the 70s. You work at it steadily. The Netherlands had an advantage. They were the richest country in the world before England. They've had longer to get over it. House prices in Amsterdam fell for over 250 years from their peak. Yeah. So we've still got a bit of a way to go for London. But don't worry, London's always going to be worth a fortune. Leo writes about London and the property in London. There are hundreds of models about becoming more equal. You have to become equal as much as you become unequal. Statistically, you can't, you know. So places are becoming more equal as much as they become more unequal in their ways of doing it. It just feels, it feels impossible at the peak. You think, how could everything change? The rich are going to try really hard to hold on to their money. And that's what you get at the time of peak inequality. Once you start down, the impetus to carry on is very high, because the world doesn't end. When Martin Sowell is not replaced by somebody on the same salary as him this year for WPP, the world doesn't end. When a Director General of the BBC is paid much less than the previous Director General, BBC might not be quite as good in some way, but you know, it still goes out. And the last time inequality fell in this country, the world didn't end. And that's what you begin to realise. And then you agitate for it. Gender pay gap. Our first reporting was April last year. The next reporting will be April next year. Every single business in the country, every educational institution with more than 250 employees knows that their gender pay gap has to fall. Reducing your gender pay gap reduces overall inequality. The process has been started by the Conservatives. You know, they push through the gender pay gap. They push through higher taxes on landlords. They've actually increased the tax take from the rich quietly. So we're on the beginning for this shift. The Tory party has stepped to the left. You just don't notice it, because Labour stepped a couple more steps to the left. Right, Liberals will be stepping to the left when you finally see what they're doing. The SNP has stepped to the left compared to what the SNP used to be. The last time the third largest party in Westminster was the Nationalist Party was 1918. It was Sinn Féin. You know, there are loads and loads of signs that our times are very, very strange now.
I guess this touches on what you were just saying, but I was wondering what you thought the most effective policy levers in this country would be.
What are the most effective policy levers in the country? I'm going to do a plug now. My children are sitting here, and the only way I get my children to come is I let them sell, because I've got a little book called The Better Politics, which we're going to sell for £5. Yeah, and they get the money. I know, shameful. But this is part of me experimenting with the market. But the Better Politics book is all about policy levers, one after another, after another, after another. So go and see Sol and Izzy if you want a copy of that or some of the other books. And go to the bookshop, otherwise I get annoyed about undercutting them. There are hundreds, but it begins with tax. It begins with taxes. Tax is the most important. There is no country that's more equal than us that doesn't tax in better ways than we do. You have a high rate of marginal income tax at the very top, not to raise money, but to help banks not pay people $6 million a year and pay them $4 million a year. You want marginal tax rates of 60 or 70% at that very top level. It's a great disincentive. That's what Germany does. It's what Switzerland does. You want wealth taxes. We're going to have them anyway, because we're going to go bankrupt. But there is a silver lining. There's a silver lining to these kind of problems. Health. You fund health properly, and of course that requires the tax to do it, and also you show people the purpose of becoming more equal, because you don't have fear of becoming ill. At the moment, if you become ill, you're going to be on the trolley and you're going to be waiting. But if you're elderly, it's particularly bad. And I'm going to go through them all. On education, you get your spending of your state education up to the kind of spending that's normal in a European country, so that people worried about their children's future don't spend all their money on the private school fees, but go, actually, the state school will be okay. And you give information. Half of all young people now go to university. Half of all young girls go to university. So if you're worried about your kids' future, they go to a state school, they're probably going to go to university. Might not sort them out, they get massive debt, but they're going to go. If you go to Eton, only a third of them get to Oxford and Cambridge. That's what they're paying for. Only a third of them get it. The other two-thirds have already let themselves and their school and their family down, and they end up in Exeter, Bristol or Durham, with occasionally Newcastle, with children who went to state schools who paid nothing. So why spend all that money where odds on you will make your child at 18 feel that they failed in that kind of way? These are the kind of things that you can begin to subtly change. I'm not into banning anything. I'm not into overtaxing private schools. I'm just into trying to help a country become normal for the rich as well as the poor.
Okay, we're going to have one last round. From here, should we just try and get these four questions in, and then Danny, you can react to them. And
yeah.
So one there. Yeah, you go first.
Can I just ask a little bit about the relationship between growth and inequality? Like, how far is expanding economic growth prerequisite for tackling inequality? And if it is, does that not lead us into a sticky situation in regards to sustainability?
Okay. And there were two at the back.
Thanks, Danny. It's just another trajectory to think about inequality. How does race and ethnicity map onto the picture you painted? Is there a greater polarisation?
And is that it? No, just one there at the back.
You might have to shout.
Beyond perfect equality of outcome, what level of equality is okay? Okay. Great questions to end on. Don't forget my kids. this is the only pocket money they get. I know, middle class and mean. The growth. When you have growth, it's easy to disguise inequality. So when it's going up, you give the poor a little bit, the rich get a lot. Actual decline is far harder. So growth isn't a prerequisite, in fact, almost the opposite. Lack of growth means you have to share out what you have better. And also, countries that are more equal are more productive. The OECD's shown that. But much more importantly, they're more productive in ways which are less polluted. There's nothing wrong with having 2% growth a year, as long as your 2% growth doesn't involve pollution and carbon dioxide. And that's a complicated thing to get right. On ethnicity and race, the most unequal countries in the rich world have the widest racial divides. The USA is the most unequal. And it's not because they have racial divides that they're unequal. The inequality sustains the racial divide. You can't sustain a racial divide without income inequality. The next most unequal after the USA is Israel. Israel has ethnic divisions in Israel. The next after Israel is us. We don't think of ourselves as divided as Israel and the USA, but we are. Once you get very equal, you begin not to see racial divides. So the racial divides in Japan that there were in the 20s and 30s, there are still ethnic minorities in Japan, but the divides that there used to be, the aristocratic class divides, have gone. Iceland is a country made up of Vikings and their Celtic slaves. There is no longer any division in Iceland between the Vikings and the Celtic slaves they brought back to Iceland. I think this is one of the most fascinating things. And lastly of all, what is the right level of inequality? We don't yet know. The most important countries in the world are Finland, Norway, and Japan. And we're watching Finland, Norway, and Japan to try to see what goes wrong. Can you become too equal? And luckily, we haven't got enough time to talk about suicide, but that's the one thing you see. So everything isn't great, but suicide may actually be euthanasia in them. In that little book, actually this little green book here, The Inequality Effect, I go through what level of inequality I think is plausible, and the inequality I come up with is an 8-to-1 difference at the extremes. I think you can justify some people getting 8 times more than others, but not more than that. They have to be working 16 hours a day, rather than 8 hours a day. They have to be doing a job that's twice as good, in terms of how good they are at the job, than somebody else. And they have to be doing a job that nobody else would want to do. And you put those three things together, and I can come up with an 8-to-1 ratio. And the reason why I cap each one of those is, you don't want people doing jobs that nobody would want to do. When it comes to being better than somebody else, if it's a school teacher, you don't want anybody who's less than half as good as somebody else. So you can go through this experiment, and you can say a certain level of inequality is justified. We are miles and miles away from that. But if you're really worried about becoming too equal, go and look at what's happening in those countries. In all three of those countries, by the way, Finland, Norway, and Japan, for the last 5 years, life expectancy has carried on going up by a third of a year, and it's already far, far higher than us in the USA. In the USA and the UK, more and more people are dying earlier. In the more equal countries, people are living longer, their kids are better educated, their housing is cheaper, they generally seem to be happier. We haven't yet discovered how equal is too equal. But hopefully we will get to see it soon. I think I might be signing to tell them.
Thank you very much, Sandy. I'm going to quickly make an announcement about the next one. Don't go away. We've got John Borton in 5 minutes. Going to be talking about the history of some social housing, which will be an absolutely terrific talk. But I want to say thank you very much, Danny. You've given us hope and fear. Danny will be signing at the table over there. Two children will be rushing around with their books there. Thank you very much. See you in 5 minutes.